Okay, please give a warm welcome to our speaker tonight, Justin from the Sandbridge Home Group.
An alcoholic named Justin.
Hello, Justin.
Probably going to regret clapping before I got up here. It dawned on me as I was walking up that in addition to being alcoholics, which I assume everybody in here is an alcoholic, but we have something else in common in that none of us have any idea what I'm going to say tonight. So the idea that I was told when I first came into AA, when the speaker gets up, they're supposed to share their experience, strength, and hope, talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I intend to do that. I do want to give a quick background and thank some of my Virginia Beach peeps for coming out here, facing the long trek on 64. If all things go the way they have been going for a while, a week from today, I'll be celebrating 17 years in the program. And I say that not, you know, our topic last night at Nimmo was pride. And, you know, it hit me last night while we were in the meeting that I still have a lot of pride and ego that comes up constantly. It's one of those things that I have to look for. You guys have shown me how to look for it and, more importantly, how to do something about it. And today the pride that I really get to take, especially for something like having 17 years free from drinking and drugging, man, they'll let anybody in this place. Oh my God.
Scary.
Hey, Steve. What's up, buddy?
What's cool?
Sheriff's not out. I totally lost track. Okay, it must be the mustache. You threw me off, dude. I don't even know where to go now. Yeah. The pride that I get to take today is that by the grace of God, I've been able to do something different than how I came in here. And the best way to describe what it was like the several days before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous is exactly what Dave read. There's two words that stand out. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I've been feeling that without being able to put my finger on what that was. And I didn't even understand what the word hopeless meant, but I've come to understand that that's exactly what I was when I got here. Life was unmanageable, and I did not know that. And I was powerless to control anything, including my drinking. I also did not know that. There had been plenty of signs for years and years, but I did not understand any of that. Despite the fact that my mom already had 17 years of sobriety before my happy butt came walking in here. And I'm going to apologize because I am doubtful that I'll be able to refrain from swearing for 50 minutes. I don't think that's possible for me, but I'll try. I have a home group. Bob mentioned it. It's the Sandbridge Big Book Study. We meet on Tuesdays at 8 p.m. If you feel like reciprocating and driving an hour east, come on out to Sandbridge. We'd love to see you. It's a great meeting. It's like any other meeting that's been around for a long time. It's had its swells and troughs of attendance, and we're in kind of a trough right now. I think our last meeting we only had 15 people or so, which is tiny when 9 months ago we were packed with 50, 60 people just about every weekend or every Tuesday. I have a sponsor. His name's Robert. He knows he's my sponsor because I call him, I don't call him every day. I call him Monday through Friday because those are the days that he makes himself available, specifically at 8:30, so that I can call him. And that's all kind of tossed around right now anyways because his job has changed, and so now he's hitting me back up in the afternoon and we're talking when we can. But I have a sponsor and I have a committed time that I call my sponsor every day during the week. And on the weekend, I know that I can reach out to him 24/7. I have the privilege of sponsoring other men in the program and sharing my experience. Not telling them what they have to do, but sharing my experiences with them in the hopes that they might be able to find the same joy and love for life that I have today as a result of taking the 12 steps from this book. I was listening to Joe and Charlie on the way over here, and I was thinking, God, I love how we all carry the same message. But those guys have such an incredible manner of delivery, which is, it's poignant, it hits home, it explains to me why this is so important to me on a daily basis, and they have me laughing my ass off. I almost wrecked on the high rise at one point. I was giggling so freaking hard, and I squint all the time, and when I'm laughing, it's even harder. I think I'm part Japanese, but you know, I have a hard time seeing when I start laughing. But I was thinking about Joe and Charlie, and I love their delivery. If you expected to hear anything like Joe and Charlie, manage your expectations. I'm not them, and I don't sound anything like that. So I do want to hammer home just a little bit. Oh, I have service positions. For almost 17 years, I've had at least one service position since I came into AA. My first sponsor, I met him on a Thursday night at a men's meeting, and he said, he asked me if I knew what a sponsor was, and I think what came out was something along those lines. I'm pretty sure it was incomprehensible. And he said, do you know what a sponsor is? And I kind of gave him the Air Force salute. He said, do you think you're an alcoholic? And this was my fourth or fifth meeting it was my sixth meeting in 6 days. And I had heard enough of what you guys had said that I knew a sponsor was important. I knew this book was important. I knew that going to meetings was important. That's about all I really knew. And so he said, I'll be your temporary sponsor. Here's the key to the church. We meet Friday nights at 8 o'clock. You can get there an hour early at 7 o'clock. Do you know how to make coffee? And that was one thing that I actually did know how to do. Of course, when we got up there, I didn't know how to use that coffee maker. So, you know, whatever. He had to show me how to do that. But he said, this is the only key to the church. Right? So immediately, it gave me a sense of responsibility and accountability. I found out later it was like 100 keys. Everybody that went to the meeting had one. But I didn't know that right off the bat. And so I met him the very next night, and we jumped right into the very beginning of this book. And one of the things he told me right off the bat was that at a certain time and place, I may not be able to get a hold of him, or I may not be able to get a hold of another sponsor or another alcoholic to talk to. And I may not even be able to get my hands on a big book. And so the only thing that I'm going to be left with is my connection with my higher power. And that scared the crap out of me. Because at that point, I also knew that I didn't like your guys' cultish idea of this whole God thing. I wasn't a big fan of that. So that's how I came walking into Alcoholics Anonymous. Fearful, didn't know that I was fearful. Full of pride, ego, selfish, self-centered. Resentful at everything and everyone in the entire world because every one of my problems was your fault. And that was it. But I also came in here with, for the first time in my life, a willingness to do something different. And like this book describes, and what I've come to understand is, I was so badly beaten by my attempts to control my drinking, by my attempts to control living and life in general, that I was out of options. And so when I came in here, I was incredibly fortunate to have had that gift of desperation that you guys talk about. And so we got to work right away. So my first sponsor was Mickey Mullaney. Some people call it Mickey's Meeting. It's the Friday night oceanfront meeting. It's in the same place. Well, it's in the building next door to where it started 36 years ago, but it's been running strong. I had a second sponsor, his name was Keith, and if you look at my first sponsor, He's a small business owner. He inherited his dad's business installing furniture, mostly commercial type stuff. My second sponsor got sober at 17, joined the Marine Corps, got out of the Marine Corps, joined the Army, and then did 22 something years in Special Forces, and has done all sorts of things that he'd have to kill you if he told you about them. And then my third sponsor is a hippie with a mohawk from Philadelphia who slaughters the English language. So if you take these three, and all three of them would absolutely be nodding their head with my descriptions. But if you took those three sponsors and you put them on, in a triangle, it would be a perfect isosceles triangle of what they look like outside appearances or the language that they use to carry the same message that we carry. My point in all of that is they carry the exact same message. That this program is not for those that want it. It is not for those that need it, but it is for those that do it. And I firmly believe that. And I did not set out to be a big book thumper, but now I am accused of being a big book thumper all the time. And it's I don't know that I really am. I don't have much memorized out of this book. I carry my book every place that I go. I mean, my daughter can probably recite some of the paragraphs out of here better than I can. She's 14. As far as I know, she doesn't have a problem that'll bring her in here, but I mean, time will tell. But my book goes everywhere with me. Right, I have to refer to it often and regularly because I don't retain anything. Also, contrary to the way I thought when I came walking in here, was that I had a wonderful memory and a wonderful brain, and I knew lots of things, and just ask me, I'll tell you how things work. Now, what I understand is I don't know stuff. I don't know anything. I know one thing for sure, that a drink or a drug is not going to make anything better for me today. That's it. That's the most important thing. So, how did I get here? So, I grew up in Western New York, Rochester, big city, about 1 million people. I grew up in what would probably be characterized as a very dysfunctional home. There was always drinking, there was always pot, and there were some other Henry call them? What does he call the, like, cocaine and stuff like that?
Recreational
party favors. Yeah. There was a lot of that around. I believe today that regardless of the environment that I was brought up in, I was destined to find my way into these rooms. So I don't believe, I mean, who knows? That could change tomorrow. Someone could tell me something completely different and I might believe it. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm like a powdered alcoholic. Right? At a certain point, just add alcohol and bam, I'm off to the races. The reason I believe that, well, I'll explain that as we go along. The first time I ever saw my mom cry was when somebody had actually broken into our backyard and stolen the 2 6-foot pot plants that she had growing. I mean, they were majestic. They were beautiful. They were full of life. And she was devastated. My dad is a really good musician. He's a blues musician. He wasn't around at all. He was down in Florida. My mom and my dad were never married. Peace, love, and protesting the Vietnam War were like their favorite things in the world, and rock and roll and blues and other stuff. So I grew up with my mom and a couple of other folks. She dated one other guy for the majority of my upbringing. I knew early on that I was not comfortable just about anywhere that I went. It's become clearer as I've stayed sober, as I've recovered. A lot of memories have come back at different times. I mean, I've been making amends since I came in here, and I understand an amendment as a change, and that's what I understand. It's not when I make amends, the idea is not for me to just say I'm sorry, because people heard that for my entire life before coming in here, and I never did anything different. Now I get to change. Most of the change has been very slow. Just ask my family, they'll tell you. But there is change nonetheless. So I knew that if I was in a room with a bunch of people, even people that I could tell loved me, for whatever reason, I sought other ways of changing the way I felt. Right? And I didn't understand that until I came to AA. I definitely understand it now, and I can pinpoint times throughout my entire life where that's exactly what I did. And my behavior throughout my entire life has been based on needing to change the way I feel. And so that looked like dabbling in chemicals. My first drink was actually a glass of Riesling. It was 1982 Riesling, and it was 1983. It was a year old dessert wine. Who remembers something like that from when they were 13 years old? This guy. We were at a vineyard. I got to drink a whole glass of wine, and I knew that it was tingly, and I knew that it was sweet. Sugar is one of my downfalls. And it was only 1.5 donuts, not 3, so shut your pie hole. He's accusing me of eating too many donuts yesterday.
3 minimum.
Sure. Yeah, well, 3 leads to 5, just like everything else with me.
6.
Sugar is one of those things that as soon as I started getting sugar, I would find other sugar in the house. That was literally my first drug of choice. And so my mom, as a wonderful hippie, didn't have much sugar in the house. And so what would I do? Well, I would befriend people who had, Cocoa Puffs, Fruity Pebbles, whatever had sugar in it. And I was going to befriend those people long enough so that I could hang out and get a fix at their houses and not be home, because who the hell wanted to eat tofu anyways? Not me. Those times where I would befriend people, I was using people right off the bat. I was going to people's houses so I could get something that I wanted. That transitioned from sugar into things like marijuana, which I could always get. That was my first real drug of choice, or illicit drug of choice, because I could just take it out of my mom's pop box and she would never know, because there was always so much of it. And I did smoke a little bit of pot. And what I actually did more of was I would take pot from her pot box and I would take it to middle school and I would share it with other people so that I could make friends, so that I could get people to like me for something that I had now. They sure as hell weren't coming to my house for Fruity Pebbles, so I got pot, the next best thing. That first drink that I had was nothing major. I didn't actually start drinking until we moved to New Hampshire. We went from a city of 1 million people. My mom met a guy at a wedding in September of 1983, and in 1984, we moved from a city of 1 million people to East Bum area. We lived on top of Stinson Mountain, and it was a long way from anything. And I was in absolute hell. I went from a place where I could hop on my bike, go ride around and meet up with a bunch of buddies, or do whatever I wanted to do. I could take the Metro bus and go across town to go see people. to being isolated and feeling like I was in absolute hell. Now, there is no place on earth that I would rather go back to than Stinson Mountain, that tiny little house up on top of the mountain that I finished my last couple of years of high school in. As soon as we got to New Hampshire, I met a couple of guys that drank like I immediately knew that I wanted to drink. Like, not sure if that was good English, but we'll go with it. These guys their dad had a store on top of the mountain, or close to the top of the mountain, and they could get Bartles and James wine coolers and Seagram's, whatever their wine coolers were, and all the beer that we wanted. And there was an old abandoned 1930s Boy Scout camp that we could just grab stuff and hike out to the woods. And so I started doing that. I went from being a straight A student back in New York to, and I could have graduated a year early because I had no real life, no real friends. Well, I apologize, but I'm sweating now. I meant to say this too, you know, my job in the military required me to be up in front of people all the time. And I was almost never nervous because I was very comfortable with what I was doing. And the first time I went to speak, right before getting up, I told Mickey, I'm like, man, I'm nervous. I didn't prepare. And he said, you spent your whole life preparing for this. This is you have experiences, so get up and share your experiences. And you're sweating because it's really difficult to not lie anymore. And I said, oh, that makes perfect sense. So as soon as we got to New Hampshire, I found people that I could drink with, and I plummeted as far as being responsible for anything. I was filled with anger and fear and resentment out of being taken out of what I considered a safe place in New York. You know, completely unfamiliar, and I did not fit in. I had a mohawk. I had pierced my left ear, and I got in a fight on the very first day in New Hampshire with this guy, Dwayne. Found out later that he was one of us. I tried helping him just a year and a half ago, but he took his own life just less than a year ago. In fact, no, just over a year ago, April of 2023. He was one of those guys that was in and out of the program, in and out of the program for years and years. Everybody knew him. He knew my mom well. But he just could not make a change. Another good reminder to me that I definitely didn't want to be like Dwayne in high school because he was a jackass. And I heard when I came in here, you guys told me that we all get to serve a purpose as an example. And some of those that don't make it can serve as the ultimate example of what I don't want to experience today. Right? I don't want to be in and out of here and in and out of here. It's important for me to stay in the center. So anyways, my drinking started to take off, and I basically pushed everything good away from me, and I was out of options, and the judge recommended that the military would probably be a good choice for me to get out of town. And so I said, door number one. And I joined the Navy, and I'm going to save you the drunk-a-log, but for the next, from 1988 until I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in 2007, I spent your taxpayer dollars very efficiently on alcohol and doing everything for me that went along with alcohol. And it usually meant nothing good. Not to say that I wasn't a good sailor while I was in the Navy, because I was on paper. We alcoholics, like this book tells us, we have great earning capacity. We do. We're driven. At times we're driven more than anyone around us, right? And you see it in every room, especially the guys that want to like run the meeting exactly the way it is. Like the chairs aren't set up right, you know. You know, the coffee should have been done at least 2.5 minutes ago, right? I am one of those guys, right? But that's I've turned a lot of that over to my higher power. So I am married, and I have three kids. I got married in 1995, took my first real hostage We are still married today, which tells you a couple of things. First, my wife is incredibly forgiving. Second, it tells you she's as bat stuff crazy as I am. Why else would she still be married to me coming up on 30 years? I have a son who is 24. He's active duty Army. He is in Colorado right now. I have a 20-year-old miniature version of me who is still at home, maybe. Every day he is threatened with being kicked out. You think I'm kidding? He just spent 2 weeks in jail for reckless driving incidents. Of course, none of it was his fault. And neither was the fact that he had to do 15 days straight instead of 5 weekends in a row because someone screwed up the pay that he never paid. And then I have a 14-year-old daughter who was completely unexpected, who every single day, whether she's asked or not, teaches me about humility, teaches me about respect, about honesty, and what it means to be a good person. She tests me constantly, she tries me, and she speaks a language that I'm completely unfamiliar with. I do not get a single thing that she says most of the time. Despite being married for almost 30 years, I have now discovered absolutely what all the men, all the adults ahead of me knew and tried to tell me and warn me was that I don't know anything about women at all, ever, and probably will not ever. So that's incredibly freeing to understand that because that's one more thing that I get to turn over to my higher power when I choose to do so. Again, if you ask my family, they would probably tell you that I don't do that enough or quickly enough. I was in Iraq in 2006, and I got to Iraq in November of 2006, and my wife wrote me a letter, and it was pages and pages and pages of everything that I'd done. Like everything, like the cat was out of the bag. She knew about all the stuff that I'd done and how horribly I'd been living. And I had been in Iraq for 1 month at that point. And, I didn't have time for dealing with that. And so as I'm reading this, all of a sudden it dawns on me, well, you know, I'm an alcoholic. That's what I tell her. Without even understanding what it means to be an alcoholic. But I'm using it as an excuse, like I'd done every time I was in trouble my entire life. Right? If I'm uncomfortable, I'm going to make it up an excuse for why you are causing me to be uncomfortable. I think people call that like gaslighting or something. I didn't realize that I did that stuff all the time. So, I tell her that I'm an alcoholic and the heat's off because I am lying through my teeth about every single thing. And December rolls around January and I move locations and I meet some other people and I'm right back to doing all the same stuff that I'd been doing since we met. And I'm getting ready to roll back to the States. And it's my belly button birthday is March 25th. On March 25th of 2007, I had my very last drink, which was warm Dr. Pepper and some nasty whiskey. That was my last drink. If I had known that. And the reason that it was my last drink was because there was not an easy way for me to get more alcohol. I understand that now. For a little while, I was telling myself, no, it's because, you know, I did that. I was able to manage. No, I was white knuckling. Oh, man, it's bringing up, like, thinking about what I felt like during those 2 months before I got back to the States. It was horrible. My ego was like the size of this room. If I walked into a room, my ego preceded me, sucked all of the oxygen out, and you guys were, like, clamoring for air, wondering what the hell just happened. And I was so desperate that I'd had suicidal thoughts for years, and they were usually pretty fleeting, because if I could drink, then, or if I knew that I was going to be able to drink later on in the day, or maybe even I could go a couple of days, but I knew that I was going to be able to get that relief, that sense of ease and comfort, right, that comes immediately with the first drink, then I could just hold off. I was going to be an a-hole to everybody around me, but I wouldn't completely lose my mind and I wouldn't shoot myself. Well, it got so bad that I was thinking about not just killing me, but killing someone else. It was horrible. And it had never been that way before. And I knew that I was absolutely desperate. And I knew that I actually needed to go to AA when I got back to the States. I skipped over this one thing. When I was in Baghdad, I walked by one of our interpreter's trailer. His door was open. This guy was really nice. He had emigrated to the States like 20-something years before. He was a doctor. And he, just a good dude. And he had two pictures of his sons. And at this time, I only had two boys. And it was sitting on his TV. And I kind of walked to Pocton, and he was reading a book. And I said, "Hey, how you doing?" He said, "Hey, come on in. Good to see him." We started talking. And on his bookshelf, he had this book just sitting there. And I saw the book and I said, "Hey, my mom's an alcoholic too." And I'm like, you know, now reflecting back on that, I'm like, who the hell says something like that? This guy says something like that. We spent 2.5 hours talking, and he never talked about Alcoholics Anonymous, but he told me most of his story. He didn't talk about the desperation of alcoholism, but he did talk about how dark things had gotten. And he also told me, more importantly, how his faith had grown in something that he couldn't explain, that it was something different. That it was, and I'm pretty sure if I could truly, if I had a recording, he probably said that he had found his own higher power. I'm almost certain that's what he had said. But I was so jacked up at that point, I couldn't tell you what anybody said to me. So he planted a seed in my head, but I forgot about that, white knuckled it. I come back to the States and I'm pushing everything good away. You know, people talk about getting to a bottom where they've lost everything, and I didn't lose any material things during the depths of my depravity. I didn't. I never got a DUI, never went through a divorce, never lost a car, never got in a major car accident while drinking, driving from Norfolk Naval Station out to Pungo, drunk after going to the Chiefs Club almost every day. But what I had lost was everything that was important in here. Right, I don't believe that I was born a bad person or an evil person. I don't believe that I was born with malicious intent. Right, you guys have taught me that I have a disease. Right, that I have an illness or an allergy. Right, I've come to understand that there's a couple of parts to that. There's the allergy that is triggered by drinking the alcohol, and then the obsession of the mind that keeps me from staying stopped once I make a decision to stop. You could have hooked me up to a lie detector test every time that I said I was never going to do that again, and I would have passed that lie detector test with flying colors. Right? I intended to not do that stuff again. But the obsession of the mind was such that I could not, on my own accord, stay away from it. So how the hell is it that 17 years into this, I still haven't had to go back out drinking again? Well, that kind of leads me to really believe that there's a higher power, because what other option is there for me? So I'm pushing everything good away, come back to the States on a Thursday, And I tell my wife that I have to go to an AA meeting tomorrow. So Friday night, I go to the psych center and attend my first AA meeting. This is my first official AA meeting. I went with my mom when she first started to try and get sober when I was a teenager. And I didn't hear anything. It was a room full of like 120-year-olds. There were like 15 of them, and they all talked like this, and there was smoking. And I heard one guy, I remember this, he said, "If you want what we have, then do what we do." And I'm like, "Nope, no thank you. I'm pretty sure I don't want whatever it is you've got. That might be contagious." I understand now, it would have been great. So I go to the psych center, and I don't hear any specific things throughout the entire meeting. I'm sitting there wallowing in self-misery because, again, I am still unable to be comfortable anywhere. Right? I've now spent 37 years on this planet being uncomfortable in my own skin, and I don't have a solution. And now I haven't had a drink for 2 months, and I am out of my mind. My chest feels like it's going to blow up all the time. The squirrels in my head are racing out of freaking control. I'm nervous. I'm bawling in this damn meeting from self-misery. And someone was kind enough to hand me a box of tissues, and I was embarrassed to get tissues, but I still took them because I was snotting all over myself. But I did hear at the very end of the meeting, somebody said, "Keep coming back." And I was like, okay. I'm pretty sure they said that to me, you know, because I was the most important guy in the room. And so the next night I went back to the psych center because that person will probably be there, right? And they'll know how special I am. So, you know, so I went back to the psych center and I brought my own tissues. So I didn't have to borrow anybody's, but I ran out. So I had to get more tissues because I was still sitting there wallowing in self-misery. Then on Sunday night, I went to the meeting, candlelight meeting that used to be held at the Friends meeting house on Laskin Road. And I started hearing. I heard a lot of really good things. And I heard somebody say that, because, man, your guy's stuff on the walls, like the whole 12 steps and 12 traditions, like that looked like church. They're on these freaking scrolls, and they're written in language, like I can barely even read my own handwriting. I can't read that crap. I'm like, this smells like church to me. And I mean, I knew my mom, she got sober, started talking about God. All she did is join the lesbian cult. I mean, that's what I knew. That's how freaking ignorant I was, you know? I have made many amends with my mom. I make them all the time. We still do Zoom meetings together. So I heard somebody say that they had gotten out of the debating society. And I took that to mean the whole God thing. I have no idea if that woman, I've never seen her since that meeting. But that hit me. And right then and there, I stopped. And then when I really got into this book in the next couple of weeks, it tells me, get the hell out of the debating society. Like in all facets of your life, just do the work. Let God handle the results, right? And I can say that now as, what did Joe and Charlie say, one-time president of the atheist club, right? I had a spiritual awakening that looked like this. Nope, no God. Who are you to say there's no God? Oh, I'm not sure. What if you just stopped fighting it? Okay. And that was enough. Don't get me wrong. I haven't had childish spasms of fighting the whole God thing along the way. Right? Even they say that Mother Teresa even fought sometimes her own, and I'm not trying to compare myself to Mother Teresa. That's not what I'm trying to say. That did not come out the way I intended. The point is that I have had troubles staying in the light of the Spirit all the time, and that's okay. I've come to understand that the true rewards are through the seeking of what my higher power wants me to do today. So, heard that, and then this woman, Val, I had known her husband before, she was chipping. She said, If anybody wants to stop feeling the way that they are feeling right now, come up and pick up white chip. And I like sprinted out of my chair, jumped up, went and grabbed the white chip. Didn't even know it was Val. Gave her a hug. After the meeting, she's like, hey, Justin. I was like, oh my God, somebody knows who I am. Now my life is over. What a novel idea, running into another alcoholic at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Yeah. So that my sobriety date is May 17th. My mom's is May 15th, which was the day that I actually went to, and I had no idea when I got sober. That was the day that I actually went to my first AA meeting. Odd or God, right? Divine intervention. So again, 4 days later, I met Mickey, my first sponsor. He gave me the key. Lied to me right off the bat, and that's good. Got me moving. And that night, I got my first big book. This is not my first one, although it looks like it could have been. This thing has a lot of tape in it. We got into the big book right away, and I found that all of these ideas in here, it sure didn't look like I was willing to go to any lengths right off the bat. I'm pretty sure if you asked Mickey, he would say, no, you're a pain in the ass the whole time. And I am, and I was absolutely then. But I was willing to read, listen, understand, and most importantly, put into action what you guys were showing me. And the rewards were immediate. I picked up a service position, again, opening that meeting and making the coffee. You guys told me that God was in the coffee grounds. I believe that. I believe that today. There's not too many coffee makers that I've seen that have gone back out. So, I don't know. if he's everywhere, then he's also in the coffee grounds. I mean, it's not really debatable. And we started taking the steps right away. One of the first things Mickey told me about step one is there's no working on step one. That's what you did when you were out there drinking. You were proving that your life was unmanageable and that you were powerless over alcohol. And I said, well, okay, that makes sense. Check. That was the easy one. Like normal, I've talked entirely too much about... We started taking the steps rapidly, which was incredibly important for a guy like me. Now, my second sponsor has a process of taking the steps very rapidly. And we use a series of index cards that are apparently handed down from Clancy to only a few other stages before they've gotten to those of us that have used these index cards. And the idea is that we alcoholics typically have a very narrow window with which we are willing to go to any lengths for victory over this thing. I can attest to the fact that I felt that window at times closing on me. And actually, let me back up a little bit. I worked with my first sponsor for 2 years, and it was tremendous. He introduced me to the design for living, right? He had get-togethers at his house. There was a group of us. There was 15 or 20 of us that would travel around together, and we hit almost every single Wednesday night meeting together in the Hampton Roads area between 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. Each week, we'd pick a different one. And sometimes, you know, we were the entire meeting. There'd be like two people, and we'd all roll in, and you'd see the two old-timers barely hanging on, go, oh, thank God, we don't have to just talk to each other. And it was great because we had the meeting in the car before the meeting, wherever we were going, and then the meeting, and then the meeting afterwards, and that was phenomenal. So we worked together for 2 years, and it was great. And I was introduced to a much better way of living. And then one day, I know this now, but I had already developed a resentment with Mickey. And so one day I called him, and we were having trouble linking up, even though my time was 6:30 to call each morning. But he was sponsoring like 10 or 12 guys at the time. And part of my resentment was there wasn't enough time for me to have my time. Yeah, what did I learn in 2 years? I learned how to have resentment and hold on to it. And so he tells me one day, you know, you don't have to call me every day. So I stopped calling, like a good alcoholic. And then I knew at Sandbridge, I had two home group meetings, the Friday night meeting and the Sandbridge meeting. They were both my home groups, and I knew I wanted to ask this other guy, Bob, or Art, to be my sponsor for a while. And I kept postponing, right? My ego and pride. I couldn't ask Art to... And then when I finally asked him, he's like, I'm too old to take you through the steps. I'm like, son of a... Whatever. And he was old, but, you know. Anyway, so then I got the worst sponsor ever. I started sponsoring myself, thinking that I could just manage this. I'm like, ah, how bad could it be? I mean, I've got the written directions. I mean, you know what to do. Got service position, got a couple of home groups. And shit got bad quick, to the point where I was thinking about killing myself again. You know, this is year, it was almost a full year of not being a sponsor and telling myself every day, I gotta get another sponsor. And it got dark. I mean, it scared the crap out of me. Not enough for a whole year, though. And finally, I got another sponsor working with Keith. And Keith was, he talked about big book thumpers. At the time, he's changed a little bit, but at the time, whoo, I was in for a rude awakening, and it was everything that I needed. I needed to have my head knocked around a little bit. And it's exactly what I needed because I was, my pride and ego, you know, the book talks about guys that at a certain point only thought that they had, the words are escaping me, they only thought that they had left their ego at the door. That's not what it says, I'm paraphrasing. But that's exactly what had happened. And I needed to be knocked down a level. And it was a couple of simple questions from Keith, like, did you think about killing yourself all the time when you were doing all the stuff that you were supposed to do? No. So do you think you're doing all the stuff you're supposed to do? Oh, no. Okay, well, let's get going. And so we did. And so then I had a third home group, Monday nights, the 213 group in downtown Norfolk. And that was good because I'd call my mom on the way there, have a meeting with her. And I'm so out of time. So let me tell you where I'm at today. I can't imagine life without having a set of simple directions that I flagrantly disregard at times and still reap all of the benefits that you guys have shown me are available to a guy like me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't do anything perfectly. The saving grace for a guy like me is, and it's written in here, that the whole idea is progress and not perfection, right? I can strive for a perfect connection with my higher power. That would be ideal. I have no idea what that looks like. I'm kind of scared of that too. And I can say I'm scared of things today. You wouldn't have caught me dead saying that before I came into AA. The most important thing that I get to do today is work with other alcoholics. That is keeping me grounded like nothing else. It keeps me in the book. It keeps, the minute that I'm not connected to my higher power and I'm spiritually unfit and I go to do something like I used to do and I'm like, oh, right before I see that it's a character defect, all of a sudden I'm like, what the hell would you say to one of your sponsees if they were doing that? I'm like, oh, I better not do that. I mean, that's a hypocrite. Who wants to be a hypocrite? You tell me to finish, Scott? Are you clapping for me? Whatever. We are not a glum lot. That was one of the other first things when I got here. I thought you guys were all absolutely insane. Come to find out, I was right. And I fit right in with you. I'm glad we're not a glum lot and that we get to stay in the solution today, helping others and helping other people to find, other alcoholics to find their way from hopelessness into the hope of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm sweating. Is it hot in here? Oh, you didn't turn it off yet.